This is a podcast from RTE Radio 1.
Welcome to this week's selection from the 11th Hour podcast.
You're listening to the 11th Hour, we're talking about John Houston. On the occasion of a centenary conference organised here by the Film and Digital Media School at NUI Galway. Joseph McBride, Assistant Professor at Cinema at San Francisco State University. You knew John Houston.
Yeah, I actually was the writer of the AFI tribute to Houston in 1983.
Which won various awards.
Yeah, the Life Achievement Award. And then I acted with him in Orson Welles' unfinished Other Side of the Wind, in which Houston plays a legendary monstrous film director.
Another monstrous.
Yeah. I follow, my role in the film is to follow him around asking questions because I'm writing a book about him. And I'm asking intrusive film buff questions that get his goat constantly throughout the film, and it's a satire of Hollywood. So I was around him. He was very cordial, but enigmatic and aloof at the same time, and that's part of the riddle of Houston as a filmmaker, too, that I'm going to talk about who is John Houston at this conference, because he seems very accessible in a lot of ways and very entertaining and very... welcoming into his world, and yet the man himself is hiding behind his eyes, the watchful nature of his work, not revealing maybe the innermost secrets of his personality, except in certain films. So that's what we're going to be talking about in the conferences.
What was he like to act with? Did he give you space in the set, or you just have to just
find
your own space?
Well, I was sort of tagging him around. I watched him working with Orson Welles, he was he was sort of doing his own thing, and I was just sort of following him around, asking questions, and it was kind of a strange interaction. My big scene with him, he was supposed to pinch my cheek and say... some sarcastic comments, but he was in Morocco making The Man Who Would Be King, so we had to use a double to do the scene, so he didn't get to pinch my cheek. I was doing the scene to a tall young man wearing a safari jacket standing on an apple box.
Standing on an apple box, they pinched your cheek for the 17th time.
Yeah, the funny thing was we were shooting this film and Houston, they said, oh, John has to go off to make a film, and he went off for, it seemed like no time at all, and went off and made this great masterpiece sort of offhandedly. In his 70s in Morocco, and he came back and we were still diddling around doing the same stuff that we'd been doing when he left, and we went on for years. But my favorite moment on that film was when I was cast in the film, I asked Welles who's playing the role, and he said it's either John Houston or Peter O'Toole doing his imitation of John Houston. And he shot around him for 3 years, and Houston finally showed up, and I was thrilled, and I met him, and I opened a door, and he was putting his pants on, and I apologized. I said, Mr. Houston, I've been waiting for you for 3 years to be in this film. And he looked suddenly very shocked. He said, you've been in this picture for 3 years? I think he realized what he was getting into, and we shot for 3 more years. And so I got to be around.
And it was never finished?
Never, not yet finished, but it's still in the works.
6 years. Ruth Barton of University College Dublin. You're giving a paper at the conference on the title of Adapting Moby Dick. Much of Houston's work was about adapting novels. Had he a particular skill at that?
Yes, he did. It's interesting for someone who is always seen as a maverick and a man of action, the extent to which he was drawn to text and to books, and often to very famous books. And Moby Dick is one of the great American classics. So it's very interesting looking at the difference, and sometimes you have to kind of try and peel away the image when you're watching the film, and sometimes almost put the image to one side and say, what's in the film that is in conflict with the image? And I think Moby Dick is very interesting because on the one hand it seems to be the kind of ultimate macho tale of the man who's on the trail of the great white whale, and this is man against God, or man against evil, or however you want to interpret Moby Dick.
Man become evil.
Indeed, and this is of course the question that the book raises. And so when you're looking at the film, it's easy to just say, oh, this is another exercise in machismo. But when you actually look at it again, it's really a dissection of evil. And I think it's an interesting film to appear just after, or reasonably shortly after World War II, because it's a film that's saying, has God made man evil, or has man made man evil? So it's a film that encourages you to think if you give it the time. But it's also a film, of course, that has many flaws in it, and I think you'd maybe suggest that Gregory Peck was one of them. And in fact, we were just talking about Orson Welles, and Orson Welles has an extraordinary part in Moby Dick as the priest at the beginning, Father Mapple, who lays out the story of Jonah and the whale and lays out how the film is going to go for much of it. And his is such a towering performance that when Gregory Peck then steps in as Captain Ahab, many people have said, well, really, couldn't Orson Welles have been Ahab, and that might have made it a very different film. Because extraordinary as Gregory Peck is, he really probably was not the right man for the role.
But Moby Dick's about the internalization of emotions and feelings, and I actually thought Gregory Peck was great in that movie. I thought this whole inner pain and torment and secrecy.
I asked Houston why he didn't cast Orson Welles. I had the same thought, and he said, I didn't think there was room for two whales in Moby Dick. But I think Peck is actually fine. I think he's very intense and very thoughtful, and I disagree on that.
I think he sometimes looks a little lost.
What other flaws you see in the film other than Peck?
Course, the trouble is, from our perspective, the other flaw is the whale. The whale is looking a little bit latex in this movie, particularly when you see too much of him. And I think later on...
Oh, that's because the new film. When I saw this film when I was a child, that whale was scary.
Coming to get you.
Yeah. I live by the sea, and
you didn't go near the water again after that one.
Well, we live by the sea, we were kind of scared of Moby Dick was still out there. But it's difficult though adapting, like, especially Moby Dick, where you've got all this detail about the whale and the nature of whale, and Melville's book is very, very complex and very, very detailed. So
the only thing about Melville's book is you can strip out the detail and you can cut to the narrative. And if you strip out the long, long passages about what is a whale and thoughts about what is life today and what's happening to me, which are often Ishmael's thoughts, because he gets rather sidelined in the film. If you just take the action and you slightly rearrange some of the better lines, you've got a good film there. There is a strong dramatic line running through it.
I mean, I think the thing about Houston, I've looked at maybe two or three or four adaptations, maybe The Dead, Fat City, Asphalt Jungle. I looked at a few of the texts, the original texts, and what he seemed to be capable of doing was knowing why he liked the book. He knew why he liked it, and what I find remarkable is he lifted enormous sections of the book. He didn't try to reinvent the book. He would take dialogues, I was reading Fat City there, and he'd take entire sequences, and you'd think, well, that's the most incredibly faithful adaptation. And yet, of course, he knows why he's telling the story, and that's an extraordinary skill, I think.
I think what he did was he sort of channeled the original authors, and he tried to enter into the worlds and the mindset of, when he did Kipling and The Men Who Would Be King, he said He wrote a lot of dialogue, because there's not a lot of dialogue in the story, but he used Kipling phrases and turns of phrase that he knew from deep immersion in Kipling's work. So it has the style of Kipling, even though it's a John Huston adaptation.
Of course, we have to remember that actually Ray Bradbury wrote the script to Moby Dick, and there was some dissent between him and Huston, because Huston then fiddled around with it, and Ray Bradbury was just not too happy about this, and then he got his own back by writing a book about how he wrote the script, and he created his own monster in Huston and that. So there are many egos at stake in this whole process.
But you must also remember that when Moby Dick was made, the technology which to shoot whale scenes, and you hadn't got the CGI at that time, so it was quite difficult.
Oh yes, and much of it, of course, was shot in studios, so they were limited by...
And, of course, in Yarn and County Cork.
Indeed.
Houston actually climbed inside the whale because they had two mechanical whales and they lost one. And it's actually true. I asked his script girl and she said, he climbed inside the whale with a bottle of whiskey and said, don't lose this whale. it's a true story.
Yeah, obviously with a bit of a character. You're listening to the 11th Hour. I'm Pádraic Bradach, and we're talking about the John Huston Centenary Conference. Leslie Brill of Wayne University, or Wayne State University, Cumlishgale, in the US, another specialist at this conference on John Huston. You're giving a paper on John Huston in the Western genre.
I am. A particular movie, one of the less well-known of Huston's films, but it has its devotees, among whom I count myself, The Life and Times of Judge Roy Bean. This is a film that has, like many of its kind, suffered from misunderstanding of what it is. And Huston knew very well what he was doing. It's a tall tale, a very, very tall tale of a very improbable American who existed, but his existence was such that he created great legends around himself. And indeed, this film introduces itself by saying, Judge Bean was law west of the Pecos, only rattlesnakes and bad men lived. And if this wasn't exactly the way it was, it's how it should have been. And it proceeds from there, but it's really, in a way, it is sort of the ultimate apotheosis of the Western. And what interested me in particular about this film, we've been talking about Houston as an adapter, and in my view, the greatest adapter of great literature. What's interesting about this film is that it can be seen as an adaptation, not of a book, but of an earlier film, of William Wilder's The Westerner with Gary Cooper and Walter Brennan, which is also the story of Judge Roy Bean, and which is so clearly alluded to in Houston's that if you're half awake and have seen both films, you realize that in a certain way, Houston is sort of playing a solo on Wilder's melody. The opening sets, the opening credits are practically
an homage to the film.
They practically duplicate each other, and the ends of the plots duplicate each other, not just in terms of what happens, but in fact in camera work, and quite distinctive camera work. Both of them show Bean dying or dead, in one case, with the heroine, Lily Langtree, whom he has worshipped from very much from afar all his life, going slowly out of focus and disappearing into time and mists that way.
But Judge Roy Bean wasn't the only Western that John Huston made.
No, well, we just watched one tonight, The Misfits, which is an extraordinarily, a modern Western, and in my view, an extraordinarily great one.
It hasn't received that critical acclaim worldwide, The Misfits, has it, Tony?
I think it was before its time in many ways. One of the things that you think about when you see it is, you know, when you tend to talk about the collapse of the Hollywood system and the Hollywood type of filmmaking, you tend to put it in mid-60s, maybe, you know, it depends who you ask, kind of a thing. Well, this is a film that was pretty damn bleak about the West. Clark Gable is an old cowboy. And this is in 61. Remember, The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance is 63, which is supposedly a pay into the West and the West gone and the myths of the West and so on by John Ford. So I think it's a film that's probably about 10 years before its time. But its reputation has grown over time. And perhaps the black and white element of it has put off more modern audiences.
Because colour was well in at that stage.
I mean, it was available. But yeah, I mean, but what I mean is that the modernness of it perhaps is underappreciated in terms of its sense of wistfulness and regret.
It's quite a scope, though.
It's a dark
from Sierra Madre, which is not a big party either, to Misfits. Quite a range, isn't it?
Indeed, he made another Western as well, The Unforgiven, which was the one film he said that he couldn't bear to watch, and I think it was because it portrays Indians in a sort of John Ford at his worst way, as foolish savages who can't shoot straight, who run imbecilically into the bullets of white men, and so on. There's a moment in The Misfits that we saw tonight that I think is much, much closer to Houston's feelings and sensibilities. As they come in to the rodeo, there's a great crowd of enthusiastic, half-drunk Westerners all ready to celebrate the rodeo and all that goes on around it. And in the midst of this, Houston, for about 5 seconds, lets the camera dwell on a single Native American Indian, who is standing there quietly, neither looking scornful nor angry nor enthusiastic, impassive, but clearly not part of what's going on. And that, it's like a strange chord in the middle of a symphony. It is there for a moment, and it tempers everything that follows, really. And the sense that is dominant in the film of a dying way of life, of a way of life where they have, as Clark Gable says repeatedly, they've changed it somehow.
The Native American doesn't care.
But the Native American is utterly emblematic of that. His life has died and gone away already, and he's left to make what sense of this mess he can.
That's very poetic. But Houston was, as I'd say, an Irish Ildonach. He was multidisciplined. He could paint, write, adapt, and he also did many genres of film. Film noir, The Maltese Falcon was his actual first film, and that's in the film noir genre.
I don't know what you think about this, Joe, but I think some directors during that period defined themselves by the genre in which they worked, and the most famous example is obviously John Ford. Mm. But there were others like Minnelli and Wyler and so on who worked and they were assigned projects within genres which they had some success with, and that's the other side you have to.
But certain people are good at certain type of films.
Well, and they had a success, and they give that one again. Yeah. And the thing about Houston is, and I think one of the reasons I wanted to have the conference was not only to sort of celebrate him because we became aware of him when we established the school here, and aware of that he had spent some 20 years living down the road from us in Crockwell. And we visited his house several times, St. Clair's, and, you know, and became more and more interested in him. And I became aware that there wasn't quite the cult of scholarship around him that you have around certain other directors. And I wondered why that was. And the only answer, and the obvious answer, is that he was difficult to grapple with. What did he make films? What linked these films about? Was he just a sort of a gadabout who took whatever work was going and sort of used it to fund his travelling about the place? And the more I've looked at his films, and Leslie's written a book on him, and Joe knew him and knows a great deal about his work, and the more I've looked at his films, I begin to see certain strands emerging. And the most obvious strand, which has come up in the small amount of critical literature about him, is his interest in men and masculinity and the male condition. And if you look at films as disparate and as strange as you mentioned, The Maltese Falcon, where it's, let's say, Fred Dobbs in Sierra Madre, Dix, played by Sterling Hayden in, say, Asphalt Jungle, the character Billy Tully, played by Stacey Keach in Fat City, Gabriel Conroy, played by Donald McCann in The Dead. These are extraordinarily different stories from different periods and different writers. What connects these? And you can begin to ferret out connections. And one of the connections I've sort of become interested in is the way in which his men are disappointed or disillusioned or misled or have misled themselves. And that is a strain you see throughout his work. And I think the way to approach Houston is not necessarily generically, but maybe
some way that he shows off as men is by the quality of femme fatale. In his world, men are men and women are to stay at home.
Well, I think when we did the AFI tribute to Houston, we thought, okay, we'll do a montage of Houston's women.
Right.
And that proved to be very difficult because we had a hard time finding four or five good scenes to show with women that were, you know, actually, because there weren't very many interesting female characters in his work. There were a few obvious ones. But later he began giving better roles to women in The Dead, and working with his daughter Angelica helped open him up a little bit. But getting back to Tony's point, it's very much a men's world, and they're very vulnerable and flawed men, and he deals with male insecurity, but he also deals with that as a general human condition, that we all are disappointed and we try things and fail spectacularly at times.
Tony, Houston was lucky that he worked with actors like Bogart. He was one of the first to discover Bogart and did a lot of work with him.
Yeah, seven films, Joe?
Well, I off the top of my head, I don't know. But I was talking to a cab driver in London yesterday, and I said, I'm going to Galway to talk about Houston. He said, oh, Houston, yeah, he worked a lot with Bogart, didn't he?
Yeah.
That's kind of what sticks in people's minds. He gave Bogart some of his most important early roles and recognized that Bogart could do any kind of character.
Yeah, I mean, I think that he had remember Bogart, the great joke about Bogart was from an upper class, upper west side, very rich family of doctors. He was not a down and out, he was not a street guy at all. And that's how he was cast in his early films, carrying a tennis racket about. And it was only after Maltese Falcon that people saw a streetwise, slightly cynical view of Bogart. Bogey and Houston got on very well because they drank a lot together. The famous story that Jack Cardiff tells in his book Magic Hour about how everybody got diarrhea and was gravely ill on the set of African Queen except Bogey and Houston.
Because they were drinking.
Because they drank. Yeah. They never touched the water.
They never had water, whiskey. Yeah. Yeah. Well, he's great as Fred C. Dobbs. That's a daring kind of role, and he was a little uncomfortable about playing such a despicable, low-life, crazy person, but Houston encouraged him to go with various facets of his personality. And also Charlie Olmert in African Queen, he was skittish about doing that at first, but Houston egged him on. Bogart was a little overly cautious sometimes about his roles, but he needed pushing. Mm. And Huston knew how to play people beautifully. He didn't say a lot to actors, but he always said the right thing. He told Katharine Hepburn to play the role like Eleanor Roosevelt, mm-hmm. for example, because she was playing it sort of mean and haughty, and he wanted her to be more of a gentle lady. Nice. Yeah.
I have a friend who has a theory that Huston directed all of his men to be like just like him at one point or other. And it's an interesting theory, because if you've seen Noah Cross or John Huston do whatever he does, sooner or later somebody behaves just like Huston in a Huston film. So it's an interesting parlor game.
Well, it's probably the nature of all art that you create an image of yourself. Roddy Flynn of Dublin City University, you were here giving a talk on the Huston Report. This is interesting. What is the Huston Report?
Well, briefly, I mean, Huston had been living in Ireland from the early 50s to the mid-1970s, and he became an Irish citizen, I think, in 1964. And there's a piece of footage in Peter Lennon's documentary, The Rocky Road to Dublin, where Huston says, well, when I became a citizen, I sort of, for this country, I thought, well, what can I do for my country? And since I'm involved in film, that's obviously the thing I should do. So he, when he was making Sinful Davy, a sort of a best-forgotten film, 1967, he invited Jack Lynch, then Taoiseach, to the set. And it was a setup. He had had a script written for him by his publicist for some 20 years about how there could be a film industry in Ireland, and how it was about time the state basically got off its ass and did something. So Lynch was very polite. He listened to it and he said, my thoughts entirely. Let's set up a committee, and would you mind running the committee? And basically Huston said, yeah, no problem, I'll do that. I don't think he was too happy, though, with the kind of conclusions, though, that his own committee...
What were the conclusions? What were his own conclusions, the ones that were foisted upon him?
Well, I mean, it depends on who you believe, and obviously kind of Huston's gone, so we can't ask his side of the story, and he said very little about it afterwards, except the only quote I found is that he regarded the whole thing as a publicity stunt. In retrospect, so what we hear is, if you like, the victor's side of the story.
Well, we hear that we wouldn't have Boris Gunn on the Héireann without the Huston Report. That's what we hear.
That's certainly arguable. Huston, I think, was looking for a way to keep making European films in Europe, and he was looking for the state to kind of to at least partially underwrite that in this case by giving development funding. But when the committee was put together, it was the great and good of Irish kind of film, the Irish film world, such as it was in the 1960s, which wasn't a very big world. And what they were interested in was not about kind of maintaining the kind of films that Huston were making, which were just completely different from anything that Irish filmmakers could envisage, because there was no industry at that stage. They were interested in making short films. They were interested in sort of in gearing up. And that's what Gesundheit, and that's what at the end really comes out of this. There's a SOP to Huston that they agree that they'll make development finance, that's pre-production finance for international features, like the kind of thing that Huston was making. But the two major things that came out of it was that they would set up a film board, and that the film board would fund very low budget features, the kind of things Irish directors were going to make, 50,000 budget films, and they would put an awful lot of money into short film production as well as a way of, if you like, training people up. Now, Huston wasn't happy about that. I mean, Huston essentially absented himself from the meetings.
He wants the tax breaks for the big features and to use Irish talent and Irish scene and Irish scenery.
I suppose you could say that in a nutshell. I don't want to be too cynical about it, because it has to be said that
I haven't been cynical.
Well, the point is, at the end of all this, having absented himself, I think he went off to make A Walk with Love and Death, in Summer of the Continent. He came back, you know, for the press release and the kind of the photo op at the end, and he stood over the report. He said, "Whatever's in this, I don't really care. But if Irish filmmakers think it's good for them, fair enough. I mean, I'll stand by this." And out of that comes a film industry bill in 1970, which was never passed. It never got through the Dáil, but which would have created a Boris Gunn on the Héireann in 1970 rather than in 1981, 11 years later.
We have to wait for Michael Dee to do that for us. Now we're talking to Victoria Amador of Heriot Watt University in Edinburgh, who's giving a talk on the melodramatic conscience in the film In This Our Life.
That's
In
right.
This Our Life, I'm not familiar with it. When did it come in Huston's career?
Well, it's his second film, right after The Maltese Falcon. And he wasn't terribly fond of it, actually, when he was making it. There were all sorts of neuroses that were going on at the time of the filming. But it's actually quite a wonderful film. And one of the things it does do is shows how well he works with actresses.
We were just talking about that a couple of minutes ago, how the women in Huston's film, they were kind of ciphers and one-dimensional characters, but this was not the case in This Our Life.
Absolutely not. One of the reasons being Bette Davis, who was, of course, a huge star at Warner Brothers at that time. And in fact, Huston talked about directing her, and he said that people were afraid of Betty's demon because they were afraid that if they let it loose, she'd eat them alive, starting with their ears. But he liked that and felt, actually, he says this in his autobiography, that he guided her to one of her best performances. And also, another reason I think the film is interesting is Olivia de Havilland is in it, playing Betty Davis's sister. And at the time, Huston was having an affair with Olivia de Havilland. So that also gives the film kind of an interesting edge and guides her performance in a very tender way, I think.
So he got on with Betty Davis because he was drinking with her, and he got on with Olivia de Havilland because he was her lover. Was that the case?
Yeah. I guess that would summarize it, yes.
I saw a very obscure Huston film. It was a home movie he did with Olivia de Havilland when they were dating, and it was in color, and they were both wearing swimming suits around.
This is not a blue home movie.
No, well, it's, I mean, it gets, you know, it, well, it's a R-rated, let's say. They're romping around the swimming pool, and she's very sexy and beautiful in a white swimming suit. But he's playing a matador, and she's playing the bull, if I remember correctly. It's a sexual game they're playing together.
Well, one of the things that's interesting about that relationship, as a matter of fact, she was terribly in love with him, and he sort of appeared in and out of her life for a long time. But in his autobiography, he doesn't talk about her at all.
Really?
All he does is he places two photographs of them. One of them drinking together and one of them fishing together. Hmm. And I think that's lovely. I think that says it all. And in the film, she's very strong. She's certainly not that stereotype of Melanie and Gone with the Wind that we expect. And I think that her strength is, and her strength in that relationship actually is reflected in her performance.
Well, I had wanted to enter a dissenting vote when I was hearing all this about Huston's masculinity and his world of men. This is actually a long time view of Huston, a book that came out about 1996. A collection of essays is called Reflections in a Male Eye, a hideous title in my view. But I believe that Huston, in fact, liked women, directed them well, and that there are many strong women in Huston's films. From Bridget O'Shaughnessy and Betty Davis at the beginning to Katharine Hepburn to Marilyn Monroe in The Misfits to Angelica in The Dead. I mean, there are certainly some films that are, for Hollywood, enormously unusual in that they have virtually no important female characters, but that was the nature of their stories, The Treasure of the Sierra Madre being the most famous and obvious example. As to Olivia de Havilland, though Huston doesn't mention her by name in the autobiography, he does talk about a very famous fight he had with Errol Flynn at a party, where, and he says in the autobiography that Flynn had said something about a woman, and he called Flynn on it, and it turns out that Flynn had said that Olivia de Havilland was easy, and that led
Victoria,
to a fight.
You've got comment on this?
That led to a fight that put both Errol Flynn and John Huston in the hospital by the end of it.
But of course, Huston was the bit of that story that I like the best is Errol Flynn called up the next day to see if I was okay, which I thought was very sporting of him.
Joseph McBride. Yeah. What was the difference between this public persona of the man writing film reports, the Irish government, and the brawling, drinking, cigar-smoking, womanizing Huston? Was there two others?
Well, I was just talking last night with his script supervisor, Angela Allen, and she said, you know, he was basically a literary man, is the way she put it. And I thought that was an interesting comment because we talked about his great love of adaptations and great literature, and he was a writer, as she pointed out, first of all. He wrote a lot of screenplays for various directors before he became a director.
He also began as a writer, his career.
His
first stories were published by H.L. Mencken in the American Mercury, which would be the equivalent today of beginning your career, say, in the New Yorker.
Right.
An astonishing
He wrote High Sierra, didn't he?
Yeah, he wrote Sergeant York, which just came back on DVD and got an Academy Award nomination for that. But I think he was a very introspective man, and being around him, he was hard to know because I sat next to him once for about 4 hours when we were waiting to do some scenes for the Wells film, and he didn't say a word. He was just puffing at a cigar, and I kept wondering, what is he thinking? You know, I'd love to chat with him, but it was kind of impenetrable. He had that veil over him, and there was something hidden about him that he was protecting, which comes out in his work in all kinds of interesting ways. Reflections in a Golden Eye, which is about a closeted gay character, for example, which is very surprising Houston material, but he does it very well.
Well, he covered a wide range of material, and you will be discussing this in detail at the John Houston Centenary Conference, which begins tomorrow at the Houston School of Film and Digital Media at NUA Galway. My thanks to my guests, Joseph McBride, Leslie Brill, Ruth Barton, Roddy Flynn, Victoria Amador, and Tony Tracy. Robert Altman was nominated for 7 Oscars and received an Honorary Academy Award earlier this year for his contribution to film directing. On accepting the award, he said, "My love for filmmaking has given me an entree to the world and to the human condition." To help me pay tribute to the legendary director, I'm joined now by Garrison Keillor, whose book, A Prairie Home Companion, about his successful radio series of the same name, is the subject of Robert Altman's last film. Garrison Keillor joins me on the line now from St. Paul, Minnesota, to talk to us about the experience of working with Robert Altman. You're very welcome, Mr. Keillor. You must be very sad about Robert Altman's passing.
Somehow I thought he would live forever. I just thought he would keep going on and going on because he was a man who loved his work. He just so much loved movie making. And it just feels as if a great building has come down in our midst.
You worked with him recently on Prairie Home Companion, the film. How was that experience like?
It was lovely to work with him. When I first met him, he was 79 years old. He had just finished shooting a movie in Chicago called Company, and he was all happy about that, but he was ready to get to work immediately on another. When I last saw him, it was 10 days ago in New York. We were doing an appearance together at the Museum of Radio and TV, talking about our movie, and he was fast at work on a new picture. He was so excited because he just lined up the financing for it. He had no intention of ever stopping. He told me 2 years ago, he said, "I want to die in my boots." He said, "I don't want to sit by a window waiting for it to come." He said, "I want to be missing in action." He was an old bomber pilot from World War II. He flew B-24s over Europe, and he had no intention of fading away.
He worked with you on the script of Prairie Home Companion. What was that like? Did you have arguments about what's good, what's bad, what you might put in? Or
we avoided that by having a very sharp division of labor. I wrote the script, and then I turned it over to him. He did all the casting, and he directed it. And he allowed me to be around when he was shooting the script, and I rewrote it in the process, which is a privilege granted to few. And if I were a director, I would never have let a writer ever do that. But he thrived on chaos. He was a gambler. He really... The amazing thing about this man, I think, was that he never had a moment of regret. He just never felt bad about anything that he had done. All of his movies, whether they were a critical success or not, he loved them all. It really is true, amazing as it may seem.
He was noted for his improvisational skills and for calling the screenplay a blueprint. Would that be irritating to a writer like yourself?
Yes, it was very irritating because it wasn't true. He shot the script, but he adored actors. He really put them on a pedestal, and he encouraged them to... he really gave them freedom to do as they wished. Actors, however, are terrified without a script. When you have three cameras and you're looking at a crew of 40 and 50 people, it's no time you care to be just jiving out there on your own.
You work with him as an actor. What was that like to be in the receiving end of the direction?
It was scary because he didn't tell you what to do. He just told you where the camera was going to be. He directed the cameras, and he wanted them moving. He loved these long shots in which the camera is dollying back and back and back and back, and you're walking along. And he loved to shoot long scenes that are, a continuous minute, two, three, sometimes 7 or 8 minutes. He loved that sort of a scene, but he never told you exactly how to say the lines or, what sort of gestures he wanted. That was up to you.
And on take two, would he suggest maybe you shouldn't do this, you shouldn't fall down at that stage or whatever?
No, he didn't. He always said, well, let's do it again just in case. And then his high compliment was, well, that was quite adequate, he would say.
Quite adequate.
That was about as extravagant as he got.
It was funny that he was nominated for 7 Oscars and eventually was just awarded 1 by the Academy itself. Did his colleagues and peers not like him and wouldn't vote for him, or what was the reason?
The awards are corrupt from beginning to end. I mean, they're so political. And there are large blocks of votes that really are sort of corporate votes. I mean, the whole system is corrupt. But he was a very cheerful man in the midst of it. He was a maverick, of course, but he was a very happy maverick. He didn't spend much time being embittered whatsoever. He worked at whatever he was allowed to work at, and was grateful for it.
In Prairie Home Companion, was Robert your first choice of director?
I would have been happy to make it with almost anybody who was going to make it, but I'm so glad in retrospect that he came along. His wife listens to the radio show, and that's really how we got to him, because he already knew the show. So we just moved right into a partnership. There were no negotiations as such. He was 79 years old, and when you're 79, you don't go in for long negotiations.
You don't waste much time.
No.
He started working about 40 years ago, and he worked for 40 years. He was kind of slow to get going in his film career.
Yes, it was difficult for him to get a foothold. He had come back from the war. He was a veteran, so he wasn't about to, he wasn't about to kowtow to anybody. I think that was his problem. He came back from the war having seen so much in the war, and he wasn't equipped to become somebody's assistant. So he batted around Hollywood for a while. And then he got into making industrial movies. He did some television. It was a long, slow way to make it up to MASH, where, as you pointed out, he was like the 17th guy to look at this script, but he was the perfect one to make it.
Why was that? Because MASH was a very strange, dark, black movie.
It was a very funny movie, and for a young person, I was in my mid-20s, in America at the time, with Vietnam going on, it was the movie that we needed in a dark, grim time, to have this anti-war movie. But it was an anti-war movie about another war come along, and to show us some style and humor, which we desperately, desperately needed.
Of all his films, which one would you consider your favorite?
Oh, there were so many of them. There were so many moments in them. I loved Gosford Park. There were shots there that only Altman would have made. Long tracking shots showing people working
in the scullery and in the kitchen downstairs from the great country house. I love Popeye, his movie with Robin Williams, his musical. And I loved Come Back to the Five and Dime, Jimmy Jean, Jimmy Dean, which not many people remembered because
not many people saw it. I'm sure we're all sad this evening on the passing of Robert Altman.
He was a great man, and he left the world as he wanted to. He was in full stride, and he was busy working on something, and then he went into the hospital, and he went down fast.
That's probably the best way to go. I'm obliged to you for speaking to us, Garrison Keillor. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, sir.
I hope you enjoyed this week's edition of the 11th Hour podcast. The 11th Hour is live on RTE Radio 1, Mondays to Fridays at 11 p.m. From me, Páraic Branach, and the rest of the team in the 11th Hour, Slán.
You've been listening to a podcast from RTE Radio 1. For more details of our podcasts, visit rte.ie/radio1.